I guess it was just a gradual, like the domino effect, you know, one fell and another, another, another. And I started researching the other viruses. I'm like, well, maybe there is something to these other ones as well, not being proven to exist. If HIV doesn't exist, why would the other, where did they purify and isolate, you know, the measles virus or influenza? And so that just kind of took off, and I started researching this and little by little piecing the whole thing together, even going into antibodies and all that stuff. It's just, you know, fraud built upon fraud.
Greetings and love, you beautiful humans. It's Ben Hardy, co-host of the Terrain Theory Podcast. My co-host Mike and I brought on yet another Mike to the show. This time, it's Mike Stone, founder of Virology. No, not virology, the field of pseudoscience responsible for perpetuating the germ theory nonsense. Virology. There's a lie in there. Check the show notes for the link. Mike's website, virology.com, has become a go-to resource for folks exploring the no-virus topic. When you have these conversations with non-believers, and I guess you'd call them believers, about the virology lie, inevitably you'll hear, well, what about this virus? Surely that exists. Whatever this virus is, chances are Mike Stone has done the research on it and exposed the pseudoscientific underpinnings for its supposed existence. Chickenpox, monkeypox, smallpox, Ebola, AIDS, HPV, influenza, he's exposed them all, including, of course, coronavirus. He's a legend in this space, and it was a pleasure and an honor to bring him onto the show. So here we go. Welcome back to Terrain Theory. All right, we are live. Mike Stone, welcome to the Terrain Theory Podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
It is a pleasure. Let's get a little backstory from you. Who's Mike Stone?
Who am I? Well, I mean, I guess what people like to know is my background. I graduated in 2004 with a exercise science degree. And so my original goal when I got out of college was to become a personal trainer. That's what I was really interested in. I was always focused on health and what I could do to not only improve myself, but help others. Especially with my family and friends, I was always trying to work with them to get them to be the healthiest version of themselves that they could be. And so that was my primary focus. And I did that for a while. I was a personal trainer for a few years. But I ended up, injuring my back, in my L5S1 area, which unfortunately kind of derailed my personal training career. So my focus then became more on, well, if I can't physically do the things that I need to work with people, what can I do more along with the mental side with motivation and working with them to establish goals? So I actually ended up going into health and wellness coaching and primarily just working with people over the phone and trying to help them overcome, you know, ambivalence, what it was that was keeping them from being able to make the right choices or to stick to whatever goals that they had set for themselves. A lot of people I've worked with were like smokers, people trying to overcome addiction in that sense. And so, or just, you know, maintaining an exercise schedule, something that they, you know, would be really good at for a while, but then might fall off. So then we would work on trying to figure out what were the root causes that might be keeping them from being able to attain their goals. So that became most of my focus after that point.
Got it. And how did you injure your back?
I wish there was a really cool story. I was running late for a client one morning and I bent down to pick up a t-shirt and pop, just fractured my L5 like this. It's called the pars deferens. It's just from my understanding, it's like these little things that keep your vertebrae in place, and mine typically slips from side to side, and where the nerves come out, it pinches. It will become either, you know, smaller and pinch on those nerves. And so I've been dealing with that kind of pain from the L5S1 down the leg this has been like 16 years now. But then I also have cervical spondylosis in my neck. and which they say is, I think, just arthritis. But I get the same thing where it pinches on the nerves and it goes into your arm. So basically, it's like the entire body, if it gets, you know, really bad, just can be just inflamed and require a lot of rest. And
so I imagine then you're no stranger to the allopathic system. You would have had to address the original back injury through that system, painkillers, right? I'm sure you've been on the painkillers.
Yeah, that, you know, in all honesty, just that journey, just going through trying to heal my back. I mean, when they've initially diagnosed it, I think the doctor, if I remember correctly at the time, he wanted to jump right into surgery. He's like, oh, you have to have your spine fused. And, you know, this involves, you know, pretty big surgery where they insert these metal rods into your back and they try to get the spine so it just fuses in place and it can't move. And that's supposed to help, you know, with the pain. And I did. I actually originally signed up for the surgery and I was on it. And it was like a week before that I was about to do the surgery. I just kind of had this weird feeling like, should I really be going through this? You know, I know it was, I was in a lot of pain, but are there better options than surgery? I always thought of surgery as like a last resort. And when I started researching it, for some reason, I had a odd feeling about the doctor. I ended up looking into his background and noticed that he had actually lost his license in some other, I think it was Minnesota or some state, and for doing some fraudulent surgeries and stuff like that. I'm like, that's all I needed to hear. I'm like, that's it. I'm out. I'm not going through with this surgery. I need another opinion. And so I ended up going, I live in Iowa. So I was in Des Moines, living in Des Moines at the time. And my family is from Sioux City. So I went about 3 hours to Sioux City to get another opinion from a different doctor. And he was a family friend. And he said, he kind of went 50-50. He's like, you know, you could have surgery and might help you, but you could also wait. And he's like, if you were my son, I would tell you to wait. Don't do the surgery. And so I took that advice, but still I wasn't satisfied. I was like, you know what? That's just two opinions. I need someone else. And so I went to another doctor in Iowa City and he said, don't do surgery. He was straight up, you don't need it. Don't do it. If you do it now, if you have the surgery right now, by the time you're 50, your whole spine is going to be fused. It's just going to progressively get worse. It's going to speed up the process of your spine degenerating, and you're going to have to be, you know, probably walking with a cane and everything by the time you're 50. And so that, unfortunately though, the other option was pain medication, right? Like you're not going to do surgery. It's either pain medication or they did a lot of, injections in my back. I had a lot of epidurals. So those would sometimes work, but a lot of times I was actually in worse pain after having these giant needles shoved into my spine. They tried, what was it called? I can't remember the name, but it was basically burning the nerves in my lower back. And so I had that done. I mean, I had so many different, they gave me this machine that was electrodes that I would put on my back and just, stimulate the muscles, which did help. But I mean, for the longest time, I was on those pain medications, and as it went on, they would keep increasing the dose. Like I was going from, you know, one medication to two different medications, and then from taking one oxycodone to two oxycodones at a time to like six throughout the day. I mean, it just progressively got worse. And I noticed as I was taking these drugs, like, I don't know what it does, but it kind of warps your sense of like how you handle pain. And so like pain that you would normally be able to, you know, probably deal with, when you're on these medications, it exacerbates that. You feel like you can't handle it and you need more medication to deal with that pain that you probably could have, you know, worked out in other ways. And so it became a sick cycle where I was on these medications. I almost died twice from taking fentanyl. And I went through a horrible withdrawal, and that's what really woke up my eyes. And I have to give credit to my wife. She's like, you can do this without these medications. They're going to kill you and you need to get off them. And I had a young son at the time. I'm like, I can't, like, I was always afraid that I wouldn't be able to care for him properly. Cause I was cloudy. Like my head was cloudy. I couldn't function. I couldn't think as well as I needed to. I couldn't respond to things. And like, this is dangerous, not only for me, but for my son. I can't be on these medications and live my life the way I need to. I need to find another solution. And so I ended up turning to chiropractic care and physical therapy, and just really trying to focus on doing what I could to strengthen the core muscles, you know, my abdomen, my erector spinae muscle group, all that, and just stretching myself regularly to try and overcome the pain. And it's not easy. I mean, there's just every day you're in constant pain. But I would much rather be in this pain than be in that addiction, that spiral I was in with those pain medications, because the damage, you know, you can try and convince yourself that you're not doing damage, but I know for a fact that it affected my brain. It affected my ability to think. I was a different person on those medications. I wasn't who I wanted to be. And so I'm much better off now.
That's incredible. Cut, burn, poison, I think is how Amanda Vollmer described the allopathic model. And you just, that was it, right? They wanted to do surgery, or they were burning you, or they were poisoning you with pain meds.
Absolutely. Yeah. Never really getting to the root cause. You know, I worked with one chiropractor. He's like, it's your posture. And I have horrible, I know for a fact, I have not very good posture. I slouch it a lot. And so he was working with me on trying to reestablish my posture. And it does, it takes a lot of pain off the lower back and just my neck in general, because I tend to lean forward a lot. And that could be also due to years of doing a desk job, you know, sitting at a computer, you lean forward and stuff like that. So I think for me, I learned that there are always better options. You don't need to cut, burn, or poison yourself. You can find other ways to deal with the pain. And a lot of it is becoming mentally stronger and knowing that you can handle it.
Yeah. So tell us about the birth of Virology. And I'd also like to know how this experience that you've had in the allopathic model or allopathic system has informed your work in Virology.
Sure. Well, for this site in general, or I guess the site came later. My questioning of like germ theory and virology, I guess I was already kind of hesitant, because when my son was born, my wife was always against vaccination, but you know, I grew up, oh yeah, you got to get vaccinated. If you don't, you know, your son's going to, or your child's going to catch one of these dangerous, deadly childhood diseases. So why risk it? You got to go with the vaccines. And so for the first year of his life, we were doing that, but I have to credit her. She didn't want to, but she was doing it because of me. And I was doing it because that's how I was raised. And so, but I was the one who would take him there. You know, I had to sit there and watch my child get these injections and then just cry. And every time he had a bad reaction. And the last one that he did, I don't remember what they diagnosed him with, but it was immediately after the vaccine. And I think it was the DTaP vaccine, but I can't remember completely, but he became really sick and he needed to have a nebulizer, which is a mask and some medicine that I had to sit there and hold on his face. And at the time I thought I was helping him, but you know, it was just heart wrenching, just having to hold my child and force this mask on him that he was constantly trying to take off of his face. And that's when I started putting two to two together. I'm like, why is he always getting sick after getting these vaccines? And there was a friend of mine too, who was a personal trainer that I worked with. And she had been doing these posts on Facebook saying, you know, the vaccine ingredients are harmful. Don't vaccinate your children and stuff like that. And I had seen those, but it never really, you know, I kind of put them in the back of my mind. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense. But at the same time, I still went along with it. But after that experience with my son, I went back and started looking into these vaccines. I'm like, holy crap, these ingredients, we're injecting our kids with mercury and aluminum and all sorts of different toxins. Why? What is the point of this? And so that kind of led me to start questioning just that aspect of, you know, the treatment. But I didn't question virology at that time. Just that I figured, you know, we get these viruses naturally, we're better off than trying to artificially create immunity through an injection, which is unnatural in the first place. We're not, you know, meant to be injecting things into our bodies. So why are we doing that? But then about, I think it was 2017, I had a family member who came to live with us, and this person was unfortunately diagnosed with, at first, it was syphilis. They did a series of injections, which made their condition worse. And then after that, they, as they got more sick, they said, well, it's HIV. This person, or actually not even HIV, it's AIDS, full-blown AIDS. And we're like, that doesn't make any sense, because just a few months ago, it was a negative test. How can it go from a negative HIV test to full-blown AIDS within a matter of like, I think it was 8 weeks? Like, just even on their own, you know, dogma or their theories, that doesn't happen. Like, that can say it can be latent and it takes time to build up. You don't just go into full-blown AIDS from not having any sort of disease. So that was kind of, not only was it a stressful time, but it just really made me curious. I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. And then I started researching what I could do to help this person, because they didn't want to be on the drugs. And understandably, I knew that they were pretty toxic. And so I started looking into that more. And it made me start questioning the tests as well, because we knew that this was not possible based on their timeline. And so I started investigating the HIV tests and realizing that they aren't as accurate as they claim they are. Like, even when you go on the manufacturer's list, you know, it says cannot be used as a sole basis of a diagnosis of HIV. But when I started looking into that, I would question the doctors. I'm like, how accurate are these tests? I'm like, oh, they're 100% accurate. I'm like, that doesn't line up with what I've been reading. And so they eventually ended up re-diagnosing this person with tuberculosis instead, and saying that that was what it was, which, if you look into these tests, like the antibody tests, there's like a list of like 70 different conditions that can trigger what they call a false positive, even though I think all of them are false positive, but tuberculosis and syphilis were two of them that can trigger a positive HIV antibody test. Mm-hmm. And so, then that was a course of different medications that they put this relative on, and it unfortunately led ultimately to their death. But you know, I witnessed this as I was going through this process with this family member. It was over a 2.5 year period. You know, I saw just how ridiculous our medical system is and how they can use these tests to claim whatever they want, you know, as a cause and not really know the cause, but then they'll throw you on a bunch of different medications. I mean, at one point in time, I counted over 20 different medications they had this relative on, and it blew my mind. I'm like, how can they be trying to cure someone by poisoning them? It literally did not make sense to me. And so I was investigating HIV, like I said, at the time, and that led me to the page, I think, Virus Myth. Was this is before, you know, this information was really, really heavily censored. Like, you could actually go and find it. Now it's very difficult. But Virus Myth and Rethinking AIDS, that group with David Crowe, was hugely influential on me. And it started opening my eyes to the fact that HIV, the virus, was never, you know, actually scientifically proven to exist. It never been purified, never been isolated, and that these tests were bogus. And so that was my gateway into this whole lie. But even then, I was like, well, it's just HIV. The others must exist, right? But then, I started, you know, I guess it was just a gradual, like the domino effect, you know, one fell and another, another, another. And I started researching the other viruses. I'm like, well, maybe there is something to these other ones as well, not being proven to exist. If HIV doesn't exist, where did they purify and isolate, you know, the measles virus or influenza? And so that just kind of took off, and I started researching this, and little by little piecing the whole thing together, even going into antibodies and all that stuff. It's just, you know, fraud built upon fraud.
And were you publishing your findings at that time? No, have you started putting it online?
I forgot to incorporate the blog into that. So, it's okay. at this time, you know, I was on the Facebook group, so I was following the Rethinking AIDS Facebook group. David Crow, are you guys familiar with his work? The late researcher.
A little bit. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, he had set up a group called Infectious Myth too. I think I can't remember what year, but maybe 2019 or something like that. And so I was doing a lot of posts in those groups, just trying. It was a discussion group, so a lot of us were talking back and forth, and you know, every once in a while I would chime in, but I typically was staying in the background while I was doing my own research. And then I would chime in if people had questions and things like that. But then, when COVID happened, that's when I started becoming more vocal. I'm like, I can't just sit back and, you know, research all these viruses and sit on this information for myself. You know, I was like, I can chime in here and there, but what good does that really do? So I started, doing bigger posts on Facebook. And so I would, you know, write up something. I think I started with the coronaviruses I was investigating. I'd start with polio, I believe. Mm. And so I started researching polio and doing some long posts on the studies and different things. And I would add that to the group and we'd have discussions on those. And it just kind of went on throughout maybe 2020 into the summer of 2021, where I was just doing Facebook posts. And they were pretty long. People are like, how are you doing all these long Facebook posts? Like, most of the time, I guess there's a limit, but I never had any problem. But the thing I run into is that they were censoring me a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Like anytime I would mention PCR or the vaccines, it was almost an automatic ban or censorship, or they'd take your post away. The group would get a strike or something along those lines. So I was getting kind of frustrated by that. And, I did a post, I think it was in August of 2021, called the Testing Pandemic, where I just laid out the case. I'm like, there's no virus. It's just a test. This is a testing pandemic. They're creating fraudulent cases based on PCR. And Facebook did not like that. I got like an immediate month ban for that post. And so I'm like, well, that's ridiculous, because most of the information in here is straight from the CDC or the WHO. You know, I'm sharing sources that you're calling reliable with everyone, and you're banning me for it. Why is that? Why am I being censored? So I followed that up with another post that was like 20 undeniable facts about PCR, which again was just straight from their own sources, just listing 20 different facts, another immediate banning. And so I'm like, this is ridiculous. Why am I being censored for pointing out, you know, flaws with your own sources, you know, not even flaws, statements from those own their own sources. So that people were telling me, you got to, you know, take this information, put it into a blog. Facebook is going to wipe out all of your posts, you know, get a place where you can store it. And so as they continually banned me, like 30 days here, 30 days there, that led me to explore a blog. I wasn't really wanting to do one, but I was like, this is a great way to back up this information so it doesn't get wiped out. So I created the blog in August of 2021. And that just kind of took off from there. I started taking all my old posts and off of Facebook and putting them onto the site. And people are like, this guy's controlled opposition or something. How is he getting these posts up there so fast? I'm like, I rewrote these. I'm just taking them and putting them on there. And I still have to rework some of them because they aren't formatted the same. And I was like, the problem with Facebook is you can't really bold or highlight anything. And so when I was doing that, I would put everything in capital letters. And so I have to go through and take these posts where I have all the information copied, but they're just in bold capital letters. And then I have to take the capital letters out and refine the passages, put them back in, and then bold them on WordPress. And it just became a huge process or problem. But in any case, that led to the blog, which I've been doing that now since 2021. And then recently started, I think in September of 2022, a Substack, because I'm trying to keep like the virology side more for like the papers, the scientific papers and the breakdowns of these viruses and different things. And then other topics that I want to get into, I'm doing on Substack, and people were telling me, hey, you got to do a Substack. I had some friends who really wanted me to jump on there. So I created that as well. So now I kind of have two different avenues, and I'm trying to share information and spread the word out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of folks on Substack. It's a platform that is certainly blowing up. Folks are doing what I would call real journalism, as opposed to what's being done on some of the like mainstream news outlets now. Back to virology.com. This is right. For the listener, V-I-R-O-L-I-E as in lie, G-Y.com, virology. We'll put the link in the description. This is exhaustive. I would look at this and go, this is exhaustive work. This guy has done a lot of research into what's available for the science, you know, exploring the science, the papers themselves, these isolation and purification papers, the proof that, you know, we're given that these viruses exist. But you've also done some work into the history of some of these, you know, some of the existence of some of these viruses, and which I appreciate. And it's fascinating, a combination of like storytelling and exposé, really. And I thought that it'd be useful or fun to dive into one or two specifically. And the one that popped up that, you know, we haven't done this yet on this show, really dive deep into one or two of these cases. And the one that stood out was rabies, because that's one that folks like to come back at you with. Well, if viruses don't exist, then, you know, what's rabies? What about this? And that's one of them. And I thought you've done some great work on the site, and maybe you could take us through, you know, what about rabies, Mike?
Yeah. Yeah. Rabies. It's interesting. That's like the gotcha, you know, they're like, oh yeah, those don't exist. What about rabies? Like you said, it's a fun one that they like to throw at you, like, hey, I've got you now. This, you're not going to be able to wiggle out of this one. But when you look into rabies, I mean, it's just as fraudulent as all the others. You know, I believe it was, don't quote me on the dates, but I think it was like the 1860s that Louis Pasteur was, you know, doing his investigations into rabies. And during these experiments, he could not, well, first of all, he admitted that he never purified or isolated any virus. He couldn't find the virus. So just like they do in virology today, he assumed that there was this virus within the fluids from sick animals, right? And so they can't actually find the particles. They just assume they're in there. And in this case, I believe he started with saliva, taking the saliva of rabid dogs, or rabid animals. You know, that's the fluids that they say the virus is residing in, right? I mean, it would make logical sense that if you're going to try and infect another animal with rabies, that it would be from the saliva. I've even found like the CDC saying that there's theoretically millions of particles within the saliva of a rabid animal. So if you're going to make another animal sick using the fluids, it should come from the saliva. Well, he didn't have success with that. Like, he was injecting fluids, saliva, into other animals, which, you know, is kind of a natural route, I guess, with a bite. You know, you're getting a puncture wound and the saliva is supposedly, you know, theoretically going inside of you. So that's how the virus would get inside and then, I guess, do what it does, attacking the central nervous system, things along those lines. But he could not do that. Taking the fluids, the saliva of these animals, he was injecting into dogs and not having much success. And so what he ended up doing was taking animals that he said were rabid and died from the disease, and taking their brains and mushing them up and mixing them with other chemicals and neurotropic agents, and then taking these, you know, emulsified remains and injecting them into the brains of dogs. And that is how, you know, if they became sick or crazy or anything, that's how he proved the rabies virus existed. I mean, it just honestly, logically makes no sense. If you inject water into the brain, it could, you know, potentially damage a host. Why are you taking these diseased brains of a dead animal, injecting it into a live animal, and then it's claiming that's how the virus exists when you can't do it from the actual fluids themselves? So, yeah, you know, we're already off to a pretty bad start there. But even then, when he created his vaccine, there were a lot of people claiming that the vaccine itself was actually causing the disease, not the bites. I mean, and if you look at it, the rabies vaccine is one of the few that, you know, it is administered after someone supposedly gets the virus. You know, you're not going and getting a rabies shot if you don't have a bite from an animal, right? And so it's prophylactic. And so there is no proof that if the person was bitten, that they would have ever come down with a disease. And Gerald, I think his name was Gerald Gason, he was like a leading Pasteur researcher, pointed out that in many cases, people back then that were being bitten could have gone on without any sort of vaccine or treatment and been just fine. They never would have come down with rabies or the symptoms of rabies. They did not need the shot. And so these shots were actually giving people the severe symptoms that was extremely rare. Like people didn't even see them. And so like Pasteur was actually, I think he was pulled into an inquisition or something about his vaccines, and he had to defend himself and his vaccines from the claims that they were causing death and neurological disease. And so he ended up saying, well, you know, rabies is kind of difficult to distinguish. They can't do it clinically. There are other causes. There's, you know, people that are drunk or on drugs, or if they're afraid, they can exhibit the same symptoms of rabies. So how can it be my vaccine when even people that, you know, aren't bitten by a rabid animal can come down with the same disease? So he actually kind of ruined his whole argument by trying to, you know, back up his vaccine claim. So it was kind of ridiculous to start off with. So they have had studies, you know, throughout the years, that the vaccines themselves are capable of causing these neurological symptoms. And it's even listed by the CDC that the rabies vaccine, I think it's called rabies vaccine encephalitis, is a cause of the severe symptoms. So, you know, there is no evidence that, at least in nature, that these symptoms are occurring because of a virus. It could be, you know, chemical toxins, poisons that these animals are getting into. And then when people are bitten, there's no evidence that if they are bitten and then, you know, don't do a vaccine or aren't treated, that they're ever going to succumb to rabies. It's just after the vaccine is introduced. And there's been a lot of cases recently where it's been shown that the vaccine is actually killing these people and causing these instances of severe rabies. I mean, even in, I think in India, there was like three healthy, there's like a 19-year-old girl and two others that were bitten and then received the injection and died. So almost immediately. So they knew it was from the vaccine and not from the supposed virus. So it's a really odd case.
And so modern day, I mean, have we seen updated efforts to using the technology that's available now to virologists to isolate and purify, identify this thing under electron microscopy? Yeah. Like
that's a funny thing. So, you know, the virus itself, like the, you know, it's supposedly looks like a bullet, right? They say it's this bullet like particle. I believe it wasn't even imaged until it was either the early 50s or the 60s. And when they did that, it was usual, typical cell culture. I believe it was with hamster kidneys or something along those lines. And so it wasn't like they took the fluids, like the saliva of a rabid animal, and then took just those fluids, purified and isolated a virus, put it under an electron microscope, and then looked at that to find, you know, just a bunch of these bullet-shaped particles. They added it to a culture, you know, the whatever fluids. I can't remember what fluids they used, but I know it was a hamster kidney culture of some sort. And normally what they do when they do these cultures is they try to look for what's called the cytopathogenic effect. Are you guys familiar with that?
Yes. Yeah, CPE.
Yeah. It's like the cell dying. You know, if it's poisoned, it starts to break down and die. And then based on the pattern that they see, they're like, oh, there's the virus in there. The virus caused this cell to die, not all the different toxins that we dumped on top of it. Well, with rabies, they can't even produce that effect. Like rabies is considered a virus that is not cytopathogenic. Like it can't produce the cytopathogenic effect. And so, you know, even by their own standards, they should not be able to claim that there's a virus present in this culture because they can't produce that effect. But then when they go and they, you know, put it through a centrifugation a little bit, these unpurified samples, they can claim that they find these bullet particles. And I believe it took them a long time just to even find those particles. So, you know, they're not, you know, coming from a purified source. There's a bunch of other debris, different bodies, apoptotic bodies and things like that, that are within the fluids. And then they just, you know, as they do with every virus, they just point and declare like, oh, that's the particle we're looking for. That's the virus. But you can find that same bullet virus, that particle, in other diseases. Like there's a fish virus that apparently has the same shape.
Imagine that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different viruses that look just like the rabies virus, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. Was it the Marburg virus, which I think we're hearing a little bit more about right now, and Ebola. You know, both of those were, when they were originally discovered, they were considered rabies viruses or within the same family. That, but, you know, nowadays you look at them, they're just these long filamentous viruses. But in certain images, you can see them like putting a U into like a bullet shape. And so it just depends on how they image these particles and which ones they pull out from there and then claim, you know, they'll zoom in and claim that's the culprit without actual proof that that's the, you know, ever been the virus in a purified and isolated state.
Yeah. But Mike, haven't you seen the movie Cujo?
Actually, yeah. I grew up with that fear, you know, of being bit by a rabid dog. Or I remember one time I was walking in an apartment complex and I was going by the trash and there's these raccoons sitting there rummaging through the trash. And I look and I was like, oh crap. And they look up at me and they've got these beady eyes, you know, that you can see in the night. Like, I got to get out of here. They're going to bite me. I'm going to get rabid. So it's a very primal fear that we have just off of the fact that we feel like we can come down with disease from an animal bite. But I've been bitten by numerous animals and I've never once come down with any sort of, I was bit by a squirrel, I've been bit by a penguin, been bit by a bunch of different animals. And I don't know if they're considered rabies carrying diseases or animals, but never got disease once.
Well, not yet, Mike. That thing could be hiding, waiting for an opportunity.
Well, and that's the funny thing with rabies. You know, they say it has an incubation period of up to like 25 years. So they can say that you've been bit 25 years ago, but now you're coming down with the disease. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, it's not society that's caused you to go insane. It's the penguin bite from 25 years ago.
Or the squirrel bite. I when I was bit by the squirrel, I was feeding it like a walnut and I was just watching, it was on a porch and I was watching, I think Batman Begins at the time. Awesome movie, by the way. And I was so enamored by it. I was like looking away and the squirrel just grabbed onto my thumb. They've got really sharp teeth. It hurt pretty bad. And then the nurse, I called the nurse. I'm like, well crap, do I have to get a rabies shot? And they're like, yeah, you better come in and get a rabies shot. So I went to the hospital, get ready to get a rabies shot. And this was probably like 2010, maybe 2009, 2010. And then fortunately the doctor came in. He's like, no, squirrels don't carry rabies. You don't have to worry about that. It's like, oh, I don't have to worry about a rabies vaccine now.
I wasn't aware that there were a list of animals that could carry rabies. This is according to what we're told, and those that cannot. So we know raccoons supposedly can. What are the other lists of bats, right? Bats can. Yeah, what are the other animals that supposedly?
That's a big one. I mean, they claim, like, I think cats, wolves, foxes, dogs. All those things. Dogs primarily, yeah. Are supposedly carriers of this virus. But that's the funny thing, because when you look into it now, it's becoming primarily more like a bat virus, right? Like that's apparently how the animals get it now, even though we don't see animals typically coming down with rabies. It's extremely rare that they ever come down with these symptoms. Like bats are the primary carriers, and places like Australia, they call themselves rabies free, right? Their vaccination has completely wiped out rabies there, but they still have what they call bat lyssaviruses, which cause the exact same disease as rabies. They just don't call it rabies. So that's the other trick that they do, is they will reclassify these same symptoms of disease, blame it on a different animal with a different virus within the same family, and then say, well, it's not rabies. It's this bat lyssavirus that caused it. And of course, then you can claim that your vaccine got rid of rabies, even though the same symptoms persist in animals, just given a different name.
The trick during polio, wasn't it? When they rolled out the vaccine, all of a sudden it was, there's no polio, but there's transverse myelitis or flaccid myelitis.
Yeah, exactly. Or Guillain-Barré, I don't remember how to pronounce that syndrome. Yeah, exactly. Even smallpox, you know, it was broken into measles, chicken pox, monkey pox, and all these different diseases where the skin erupts. And so that's how that they have these tricks where they can take the same symptoms of disease and find minuscule, you know, differences, and then come up with a new name or a new virus, or give it an old virus. And, or even in cases with smallpox, I mean, they still said that it caused, you know, it was indistinguishable from measles for the longest time. And there was a case, I think it was in the 1920s or something, this renowned physician, William Osler, they had brought in a case, I believe they said it was a measles victim, and all these different physicians were there, like 20 of them. And they all agreed, yeah, this is a measles case. And the guy came in, he's like, he uncovered him. Like, are you guys crazy? This is a smallpox case. Get him, you know, quarantined right now. I'm like, well, how did all these other guys that were really good physicians not able to distinguish it? But this guy could come in and say, yeah, that's this. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous how they try to fool people based on these small differences that they cannot clinically diagnose. I mean, nowadays it's all molecular. They have to do PCR just to claim that someone has a disease or a virus. I mean,
so let's come now to more present day. I'd say viruses that are causing some alarm. This is one as a father of a 6 year old, you sending a kid off to school, and so you're much more aware of what's quote unquote going around in schools and what kids are going to the hospital for, the ER, urgent care. And RSV is the one that keeps popping up. RSV is coming, you know, going around. All these kids have RSV. And you've recently dived into this a little bit. So what have you discovered about RSV?
Well, I mean, it's the same exact symptoms that you see with COVID and influenza. They just, you know, threw another name on it. And even though RSV has been around for a long time, you know, it's the exact same symptoms. And, you know, before COVID, influenza and RSV were the, you know, primary diagnoses of these respiratory symptoms of disease. COVID comes around, you obviously saw influenza and RSV and other respiratory viruses disappear. I mean, they love to claim that it's because people are masking up and social distancing and stuff like that, but it wasn't. It's because they were all lumped into the COVID umbrella. Then when they need to make the perception that, you know, COVID was the cases were decreasing because of the vaccination and all these things, you started to see influenza being diagnosed more and RSV. And what they don't tell you is they don't always look for these things. Like influenza was rarely tested for, and same with RSV. But then when they put an alert out there, like, oh, physicians, you need to be aware and start testing for us, then they start testing for it, and then they start generating more cases. But with RSV, you know, they say it's the most common, I think, virus for lower and upper respiratory disease in children. But it didn't even start off that way. It was a chimpanzee virus at the start. It was first discovered in 1956. And they had these, I think it was 20 different chimpanzees, and 14 of them had some nasal discharge. They call it coryza, I believe. But anyways, they had inflamed nasal passages and stuff like that. And they tried to culture a virus from these 14 monkeys. And they were unsuccessful in every case except for one of them. And in one of the throat washings that they did, and they mixed it, you know, with the usual, I think they used horse serum and all these different additives in the culture, antibiotics. With this one, they saw some cytopathogenic effect and then claimed that, oh, there's the virus, we've got it. They never took any sort of like electron microscope images, or they never attempted purification and isolation. They just based it off this cytopathogenic effect. Like, well, this one monkey has the virus. These other 13 that we couldn't culture it from must have had the same thing, but we just couldn't culture it. And so they ended up doing some experiments with this one cell culture, the supposed virus, and they could not make any animals sick. Like all their control animals, like the mice, the guinea pigs, all these things, they could not make sick. They were able to make chimpanzees sick, which they would take this culture goo and, you know, shove it up their noses. And then sure enough, I think they had three monkeys that they tried this with, where they took the culture that had the virus within it, and they shoved it up the monkeys' noses, and two of the three had, sure enough, some nasal discharge and inflammation because they had this stuff shoved up their noses. But in their controls, they had three other monkeys, which were used cultures that said no virus. There's no virus in these cultures. And they shoved this goo up three other monkeys. And two of those came down with the same symptoms of disease. So they literally destroyed their whole argument within their own paper, but then still claimed that this virus existed. I mean, it's absolutely mind-blowing when you look into these papers and see when they actually do perform controls, it actually contradicts the results that they end up going with at the conclusion. And they even admit in this paper that just because they came up with this cytopathic agent doesn't mean that it was the cause of the disease in these monkeys, that it had to be, you know, future studies that had to look into this. Well, in 1957, that's when a different team of researchers started looking at children, and they tried to make this connection. I think they had like 59 children with some form of lower respiratory symptoms, and they tried culturing them the same, or a virus from all 59, and only could do it in two of them. And they, I believe, of the two, they only really studied one. And with that one, again, they had difficulty trying to even create a cytopathogenic effect. And they found that, you know, most of the kids that they tried to claim using like indirect antibody results, they said, well, most of them had no disease. So they either had, you know, really low symptoms or no disease, and then tried to claim that this virus antigenically was related to the monkey virus, just based on antibody results, which I don't want to get into too much. But antibodies, you know, if you're going to claim that these antibodies are specific to a virus, you would have to first purify and isolate the virus in order to show this. And you would also have to do that with the antibodies. Well, they don't do either of those things. So they're trying to take, you know, one theoretical entity, antibodies, to try and claim that another one exists, which it's just, you know, a mixture of all these different chemicals. Without getting into too much detail, they just take a bunch of different tissues and bloods from different animals and mix them together. If they see a reaction from this recipe, then they claim it's specific when it isn't.
So it's about reading the method section of the isolation paper, isn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look into these papers, and they always, you know, assume a virus is present first, and then they jump into the cell culture experiment without ever actually showing that the virus is present. And actually, in all three papers that I looked at with RSV, none of them ever showed the virus itself. Like, they had no electron microscope images of what the RSV virus supposedly looked like. You know, obviously they didn't. They didn't ever purify and isolate anything. And so they couldn't show that. They just showed some tissue sections that they claimed were these synchial formations that were supposedly specific to this virus, which later on were shown not to be specific to it. So, if you go through the methods section, you find that they never start off the experiment, you know, the culture, with the actual virus in hand first. You know right then that they're creating scientific fraud, because you have to verify that the thing that you're experimenting with exists first. You can't just do an experiment and then claim, oh, that thing existed from the very beginning, when you don't have it, you know, the end result. So they kind of do it backwards.
Mike, have you had conversations with virologists?
You know, I don't know if I cannot think of a virologist offhand. Most of them are microbiologists I talk to. The ones that engage with me are microbiologists. Yeah.
How does that go?
Oh, as you would expect, a lot of ad hominem attacks. They always attack me, you know, the source, the person presenting the information, versus the information that I'm showing them. A lot of them, oddly enough, like, to me, one of the best barometers that you can use to judge virology as a field, or actually any science, is the scientific method. You know, if field is going to put out evidence, that evidence should adhere to the steps of the scientific method. If it does, then you can be pretty sure that that's reasonable scientific conclusions. If it doesn't, it's most likely pseudoscience. And so when I'm talking to these people, most of them have no idea what the scientific method is. And then if you say, well, this is what you should be looking when you read these papers, you should be looking and seeing, do they observe a natural phenomenon? Are they, you know, creating a hypothesis which actually involves an independent variable that exists first before experimentation? Mm-hmm. What is their dependent variable? You know, are they using proper controls, their experiments, all these things? They don't seem to know this process. And then they actually get angry with you. So, oh, that's just your criteria. That's your method you made up. I'm like, no, I didn't make up the scientific method. This existed for hundreds of years. I'm not just making this up. But this one woman, this person, I don't want to get into names, but is a Twitter user who is apparently a teacher and very much into like genomics and stuff like that. And we were discussing the foundational evidence for nucleotides. And they, as evidence that this paper, which did not purify and isolate nucleotides, like I went through and showed this, like, oh, yeah, it did. And her evidence was a textbook. She threw out this textbook, Leringer's Principles of Biology. And she's like, it's in there. It's in this 1,000-page textbook. It says right there that the evidence was based on the scientific method. And so I was like, well, that's ridiculous. I first of all, I can't access this textbook. How am I supposed to verify it, what you're telling me is true or not? Well, sometimes I stumble into things when I'm researching. And fortunately, I actually was able to find the textbook. It's like 1,119 pages. And I was able to search through it just looking for the scientific method. There was only two mentions of the scientific method throughout this entire 1,100 page textbook. And it didn't even explain what the scientific method was. One was an Albert Einstein quote, and the other was just saying that it leads to slow experiments sometimes. But they never outlined the steps of the scientific method in this Principles of Biochemistry book. It was absolutely ridiculous. And in the section when they were talking about nucleotides, it did not mention the scientific method once. And they even got the year of the experiment wrong. So I was like, how is this person putting this information forward? What I find when I'm talking to these people is that they don't really think critically or logically. Like they just throw out random links. A lot of times they're to textbooks and different things like that. And they want you to search through that and say, they'll make a claim and then say, here's the link, go find it. And I don't think they expect me to go look, but a lot of times I like to just to prove them wrong. But, you know, you see a lot of this, it's a lot of cognitive dissonance going on where they, you know, you present them with the information, they get angry, they will attack you. They'll say, no, that's not true. You created your own method. You're going off of, like criteria that, you know, have been disproven or stuff like that. It's just mind-blowing the type of excuses that they'll come up with so that they can stay within that paradigm or that, you know, the dogma that they've been taught. They can't see outside of the box, and it's kind of sad.
I think that's one of the reactions that folks have when this conversation around, well, viruses have never been proven to exist emerge. And that is, well, how can everyone be in on, you know, what even you say in your URL is a lie. How can how can all these virologists and microbiologists be in on a lie? And it's not necessarily like an intentional lie, is it?
Right. Absolutely not. I think the vast majority truly do believe in that. I mean, we've all believed in viruses at one time, I would say. Most of us. I don't know. I would assume you guys believed them at one time. I sure did. And so, you know, it takes a lot to step outside of that what you've been taught your whole life. And I don't think, you know, it kind of goes back into that whole health coaching thing. Like when I work with people, it's trying to overcome that ambivalence and figure out what the motivation is that's going to keep them to coming to their truth and their goals and things like that. These people don't have the motivation to step outside of that box and look at it through a critical viewpoint. And to look at it logically, they've been taught a certain way and they've, you know, their careers are built on this stuff. And so it's very hard to say when someone comes in saying, well, this isn't science, it's not adhering to the scientific method, here's why. And they're like, they get very defensive about it, rightfully so, but they don't really look at what you're presenting them. They just want to argue. And it's a frustrating situation to get into, but I try to work with these people. I try to be respectful when I engage with them on, you know, Twitter, which I always hated Twitter, but I made them the dive into Twitter like 2 months ago. Man, it's quite a place that you deal with there. But, you know, I try to be respectful and work with them. And a lot of times, you know, I learn through these conversations. You know, it helps me to see where their mindset is and everything. So I think in a lot of these cases, you know, there are people that do that were in the field. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with Mike Danio. But, you know, he's
we just had him on.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Perfect example of someone who, you know, is intellectually honest and was able to step outside of their field and look at it critically. Even when he was in the field, he was looking at it critically. And so it just depends on where people are at, because there's different levels. So I don't think people are intentionally lying. I think there are people at way at the top that know the lie and are you know, keeping others in the dark. But I think the vast majority are truly honestly believe in what they're taught. And if you're not taught, you know, the scientific method, if you're not taught what science is, and you're not taught to adhere to these steps, you're going to believe that the pseudoscience that you're promoting is actual science when it's not. And you're going to,
well, and let's not forget that these educations come with, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars price tags. And so it's all fine and good to say, well, it's cognitive dissonance, but there's a lot loaded on top of that statement. I mean, a whole lifetime of buy-in, literally, not just philosophically, but out of the pocketbook.
Yeah, I actually just did. I just published an article on Substack today just about the scientific method. And I can understand where it's difficult, because when I was a personal trainer, I used this example in the article. When I was a personal trainer, you know, I was a huge believer in supplements like whey protein, creatine, you know, multivitamins and all these things. And, you know, I was always reading the latest research on these different formulas and these magazines that, you know, just happened to be financed by the companies that are making these products. But, you know, I was like, oh yeah, this stuff is great. And when I got my first personal training job, the company I worked for actually had their own like, outside company that was a supplement company, and they claimed that they had these pharmaceutical manufacturing practices and that their products were better than anything that you could get out in the supermarkets. And they would come in with these elaborate presentations, with these PowerPoint presentations, and they would give us free products and stuff like that. And I was a firm believer in their supplements. Like, I was consuming them myself. They had these protein cookies and brownies, and we called them the better bad food choices. Like, they're like, oh, these things are great. You know, they're going to help my clients lose weight and they can eat all they want and not gain anything, which obviously was not the case. They had these multivitamins that we would take and they would turn your urine like this bright neon yellow. And I would have clients coming up like, whoa, this is crazy. Why is it doing this? And we were told, well, that's how you know it's working, because your body was absorbing what it could. And when it couldn't, it just excreted. There was so much vitamins in there that it was coming out your urine and turning it neon yellow. And to me, that made sense at the time. I'm like, oh yeah, it's your body working. I didn't question it. You know, I'm like, these supplements are great. I'm selling them. I'm making money selling them. I was getting commission from them. I used them myself. And it wasn't until I got out of being a personal trainer that I looked back at that and I was like, what the heck was I doing? Why was I such a firm believer in these products? Why was I trying to explain away neon urine? It blows your mind what you will accept when you're within a certain field. You don't see that, you know, that forest for the trees. You're just, you know, selling what you've been sold. And I think that's what a lot of these people do.
Yeah. And speaking of seeing the forest for the trees, I'm over here geeking out on your website quietly on the side, which I'm embarrassed to say I've not visited before. I've listened to you in interviews, multiple, and I really feel like I have a good grasp on where you're coming from and all your due diligence. But the website is a treasure trove, and it's really speaking my language. And two things that I would love to hear you speak on are gain of function, because that comes up pretty often, right. And also air pollution. That's what the link is in the menu here, but that takes you right to COVID and chemtrails. I remember about a year ago, I was driving to Pennsylvania. I live in the Hudson Valley of New York, and there's plenty of chemtrails up here. Believe me, I see them every morning when I wake up, and I look forward to that sunrise. Then takes the wind right out of my sails just about immediately. Like, motherfuck, there they are again. But we were down, like, driving through New York, like close to the city in New Jersey, and they were like the ones you see on Instagram where it's just like the patchwork of like so many. And I said, sort of under my breath, but not really, to my wife and some of my bandmates I was with, like, there's your COVID up there, like sort of flippantly. But then as I'm looking at your website right here, you're making that claim. Take up here. I just add one more story. I was on tour in Australia the fall of 2019 when the whole goddamn place was on fire, right? It was and it wasn't lost on me as I traveled back to the States, and shortly after that, California was on fire, and these record breaking forest fires, which now as I look in hindsight, it's like I question the legitimacy of that just being Mother Nature or climate change, or whether they were actually. Yes, there was more of a malicious intent there, but that's a whole other conversation. But it just, this whole idea of air pollution and respiratory illness, it's not rocket science. So what have you learned in this space?
Yeah, well, just to touch on the gain of function, since you started that off really quickly, sure. You know, if they can't find a virus in the fluids of a patient, you know, if they can't purify and isolate those particles directly from the fluids, and they can't show they exist in nature, they can't create one in a lab. It's just impossible. You have to be able to show the thing first existing in the actual host, in the fluids, and in within nature. You can't just go and create. What they're doing is they're just creating toxic soups. Same cell culture thing. They're just combining different cultures together and then doing PCR and claiming that there's a different virus. They never show the viruses. You know, they never show that they purify or isolate the things that they create. They just claim that they're in there. They're just creating more toxic injections that they're throwing into animals and claiming, you know, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Boston University study that came out recently that they were all ablaze about and they are claiming like that they they gained a function. They made the SARS, I can't remember, I think it was Omicron, more lethal than it was supposed to be. And they are claiming like this 80% death rate in these mice. And then when you go and read the study, none of the mice died naturally. They killed them. They euthanized them. And that's how they got their 80%. They killed 8 of the 10 mice and said, well, there's your 80% death rate. So it wasn't the stuff that they were injecting into these mice. They just had this subjective criteria after shoving this goo in these mice. And they said, well, if they're, you know, ruffled fur or something, like that, they're hunched up or they're lethargic, then we must kill them. And that's how they got their 80% rate. So it's just fraudulent based off of, you know, the methods that they're doing. So just that's kind of where I'm at with gain of function. I call it gain of fiction because that's all it is. They never start with the purified and isolated viruses. They're just creating cell culture crap.
That makes complete sense to me. While we're on the subject, what about there's some people out there raising concerns over, you know, nanotechnology, bioweapons, and it does get lumped in with this gain of function conversation. But do you have any insight as to, you know, that whole part of the conversation as separated from viruses? Because it could just be more toxic soup that is smaller than the human eye can see. That could be a pathogen.
Yeah, I think they would have to show that. You know, it's one thing to speculate that these things exist, like the nanotechnology and different things. And I know there's been a lot of people looking into the vaccines with graphene oxide and you know, finding different particles and stuff like that within the vaccines. But, you know, unfortunately, there's just not a lot of evidence out there right now. There's not a lot of scientific evidence. So all we can do is speculate. So is there a possibility that there's these, this nanotechnology? I'm sure that's a, there's a possibility. Have I seen any good evidence for it? No, I haven't seen any sort of evidence. And a lot of people try to say like the vaccines are, you know, they're being injected with something and then the vaccinator passing or shedding something on to the unvaccinated, which I think, you know, again, that's just pure speculation. There's no evidence backing that up. In all honesty, there's no evidence of contagion in any sense. I've never seen, you know, you look at these old studies like the Rosnow 1918 flu, you know, experiments, or I've seen a lot with measles and different influenza and common colds. They cannot transmit disease from fluids or just being, you know, breathed on by other people. That just doesn't happen. So unless I were to see some really good evidence showing that, you know, a vaccinated person can actually, you know, being around someone just in proximity can transmit a disease to them. It's just another fear-based theory that's being floated
more
out
fear
there.
Porn.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes me think of the textbook example that you cited a few minutes, the textbook that was cited as to back up a claim. A lot of people point to the patents as their proof, but just because something is registered as a patent does not prove that it actually exists in the real world.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. They can patent things and that can go nowhere. You know, that they don't have to, I don't think they actually have to prove that these things work. It just is if it makes sense to the person reviewing it. And these people typically aren't even in a science position. They just have to look and see if it somewhat makes sense with what could potentially be done. So yeah, I just look at that as more, like you said, fear porn.
Fear porn. But the crossover seems in the segue is to get into air pollution now, because it seems to be plenty of toxic goo up in the air falling on us.
Absolutely. That's why a lot of people come to me and they're like, so what is causing COVID? If not a virus, what is it? And I don't like to just say one thing, because there are so many factors that can lead to disease. But if you're going to ask me what the most logical explanation for respiratory disease is, I mean, it's got to be the air that we're breathing. You know, it's this polluted air, and we're constantly bombarded with these trails. And whether people want to believe that it's some sort of covert chemtrail program or not, there's no doubt that these things are in the sky. And then they admit, you know, in government sources that there's harmful toxins within these plumes, whatever they are. You know, they've got different metals, the PM2.5 particles in there. You know, they're damaging the environment, they're blocking out the sun. So whether you want to believe that there's other toxins or not, it's hard to really prove, but we do know that they're damaging the environment. They're damaging to our health. Our air pollution levels are not getting better. They're just getting worse. I believe it was in like 2016, Trump rolled back some of the air pollution protections and our levels increased even more since that time. And so it's not like a mystery that the air that we're breathing is more toxic today than it was, you know, years ago. And when you look at COVID, you know, look at the places that were hit the hardest. You had China, which and Wuhan, some of the worst air pollution. India was hit really hard. They have horrible air pollution. Italy, again, horrible air pollution. New York City and California, horrible air pollution. So I think even Brazil, someone was trying to argue, well, we don't, this guy in Brazil is like, yeah, we don't have air pollution. I pulled up all this information. I'm like, yes, you do. And they're like, you know, they don't want to believe something as simple as air pollution could be a cause of respiratory disease. But I mean, just think logically for a second. If we're having issues with our respiratory system, we got to look at what it is we're breathing. You know, that just makes sense to me. But I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. So yeah, I completely believe that that is a major factor in what is leading to a lot of respiratory disease. And you were talking about the fires. Throughout this pandemic, I'm putting in quotes, we traveled, my wife and my son, we traveled to Florida. But when we did that, we drove through all these places that were supposedly the hardest hit, you know, with the COVID pandemic. Or the cases, and you know, they were having people mask up and sanitize. I didn't wear a mask once. And you can get by without doing it. They would say something, but you could just, you know, walk on by and they wouldn't do anything. If enough people did that, you know, none of that would have happened. But I think unfortunately, people are scared. But why I bring that up is on our way back, I think it was 2020, it might have been 2021. The forest fires were raging and we were traveling through Illinois. And I remember I was like, man, it's so foggy here. Why is this happening? I didn't know about the fires at the time. And then I found out as we got through Iowa, same thing, just fog all over the place. We've got back to where we live. And a week later, I had the worst sickness, like just my head was hurting. I couldn't breathe. I was coughing constantly, like for 3-4 weeks, I was coughing. And they were showing downtown Des Moines. You couldn't even see the buildings. There was so much fog. And then we had a rise in cases of COVID. Well, what do you think? Mm-hmm. Was it really COVID cases, or were we just breathing in this toxic fumes from these forest fires? And on top of that, you know, you have the continued spraying. Our air was polluted. And my whole family got sick at that time. My wife, my son, even my brother, his wife, his daughter, my parents, like we all got sick. So it wasn't like we were passing some virus. I mean, if we'd gone test and we got positive, they'd be like, well, yeah, you're passing COVID around. But it wasn't. We were just all breathing in the same toxic air. And we all had similar responses to that. And we had it at different times. You know, it wasn't that we all came down with it right at the same time. Like maybe I think my son was the first to get it. Maybe a day or two later, I started experiencing symptoms, and my wife, and then my other family. So they'll say, well, there you are. You pass it from one person to the other. It's not that. It's just our bodies took, you know, time to eliminate this. And this is what we were going through. And we all happened to go through it around the same time because we were all exposed to the same environmental toxins. You don't need that.
I think the terrain theorist argument would be that you experience symptoms in a staggered fashion. So you could, in essence, take care of each other.
Yeah. That's a great way of
looking at it. It's a survival strategy, right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's interesting that you bring that up, because it was my son who was the first one. And then I obviously had to take care of him. But, you know, anytime, even though I know viruses don't exist, I'm always stressed when my son's sick. I'm always worried about it. You know, I'm like, I know fevers are a form of healing. I know the symptoms are a good sign that he's going through and detoxifying his body. But it's still stressful. And you're sitting there and you're holding your child and you're not getting much sleep, and then your symptoms might be a little bit worse because of the stress that you've gone under and everything. So there's a lot that plays into that.
Absolutely. Ben, you're going through that right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm, you know, dealing with like you said, when you have a child and your child gets sick, there's a feeling of helplessness. And certainly now more so, because you look at the quote unquote remedies that the allopathic system would offer you and you see them for what they are, which is really just symptom suppression rather than addressing any root cause. And I think in most cases, these kids are just going through routine detoxes. Detoxing with exactly what we're talking about. And part of it could just be also the natural growth process that we don't fully understand. But I certainly don't see it as something that he's going to transmit to me. However, just as Mike Miranda, you pointed out, and also Mike Stone, you pointed out, there's just high stress and anxiety because you have this, you have empathy. There's no one you have greater empathy for than your child. And I think I would say it's hard to not take on some of those symptoms. But I do want to ask, though, Mike, people will also point to things like chickenpox. One kid got chickenpox. We got the other kids together, and then they, you know, some of them erupted into the pox as well. So if we remove virus and viral contagion from the equation, it would seem that humans can communicate in some way and maybe not transmit a thing, but how do you explain something like that? And I know we're getting into the realm of like speculation and theory, and that's we don't quite know, but what do you think?
No, that's the problem. There's just not a lot of studies to support any of that. I mean, it's definitely interesting, and I think it deserves study. That's the thing, but they won't do that as long as this virus lie is out there. They're not going to study, you know, whether there are other ways that we might be, you know, transmitting, if there's some sort of, I think, bioresonance or something like that, that could be affecting people, or, you know, we're energy beings and maybe we're feeding off of each other's energies. I don't know. But I do know with, you know, an instance of chicken pox, I think it was Rudolf Steiner remember correctly, he had talked about how it was just a phase. It's like a like you're talking about, it's a natural phase that children go through as they develop and grow up, and those symptoms would come by. So why are we trying to suppress something that is a natural process that their bodies need to go through in order to be healthy? But you know, a lot of people bring up the chicken pox parties and try to claim that that's proof of contagion. But, you know, again, that's a lot of anecdotal stories. We don't really have any scientific studies proving these. Do we have, you know, any study where a kid had chicken pox and they took a bunch of healthy kids in there and then the rest of them came down with chicken pox? No, there's no actual, you know, evidence of that actually happening. And just for every story where someone says, yes, I took my child, they got chicken pox, another one said, I've talked to people like, no, nothing ever happened. You know, right. No one came down with anything. And so you can always find the other side. And when I was investigating chickenpox too, I was looking into these studies where they would actually take the fluids from the pus's, you know, from the pustules. They said that's where the virus resides, and they'd take it and put it on another kid. Nothing happened. They couldn't transmit disease. They couldn't give the other kid chickenpox. And that's, you know, the natural way that you're supposed to get it is from these pustules apparently getting onto you. And so if they can't transmit it that way in an experiment, why are we assuming then that these kids are getting it at these parties? It could just be, you know, a shared environmental toxin that they're all experiencing. Or if it is, like Steiner is saying, just a response that your body goes through as you age, they're all of the same age most of the time. They could all be going through it at a similar time frame. So there's a lot of unexplored explanation, but that's the problem. As long as we continue to believe that the virus is the cause, none of these other avenues are being explored properly. And I think that's one of the biggest, you know, sins of this lie, is that we really don't have a true understanding. And a lot of people are uncomfortable with not knowing. You know, mm-hmm. They want to know. They want to have that story. This is exactly what's happening. We know. And when you take that story away, it's hard for them. But we have to be comfortable saying there are just some things we don't know. We can put theories out. We can speculate. And it's all fine, but we have to be comfortable knowing that we don't have all the answers.
What does the future hold for Mike Stone and virology?
Well, let's see. So virology, I'm trying to, like I said, I've got two sites. So virology, I've been trying to keep mostly now focused on the actual papers. They're not really science, the pseudoscience papers for viruses. I want to continue to break down these studies on that site. I do have a Substack, Mike Stone at Substack or something like that. I don't remember what the actual URL is, but I've been doing that more, stepping outside of, I mean, it's still related to virology, but different areas and topics that aren't related directly to the studies themselves. So I've been flipping between both of those sites. The other thing, which I've never really announced, but I will do it because it's going to hold me to it. My New Year's resolution, and someone just asked me about this on Telegram. They're like, you need to write a book. And I said, that was my New Year's resolution. I have been saying it for a while, and I just have not stuck to it. So maybe if I put it out there, it'll happen. And I just started working on a rough outline yesterday. So I want to finally compile a book, make it something that is easily digestible for people, you know, present this in information. Not that there isn't great books out there already, like Virus Mania is amazing. Dr. Cowan's A Contagion Myth is an excellent resource and things like that. But, you know, people keep asking me for my own spin on it. So that's another project that I'm hoping to work on. And I just have to find a way to balance writing a book and doing the two sites at the same time. It's a lot of work, but that's my hope, is to continue down the path and you know, exposing this lie as I go along, but then also to get a book out there.
Well, we eagerly await news of the finished product, and rest assured it will be on the bookshelf behind me.
Ooh, awesome.
if and when it publishes.
Yeah.
Mike Stone. Yeah. Well, now it's out there. You've made the declaration. So we will hold you to it. Mike Stone, I want to ask you a question we ask all our guests towards the end of this episode. What are your non-negotiables, those daily habits that you do to tend to your terrain?
So, you know, there's just things I typically focus on. Just getting enough sleep. I have to get 8 hours of sleep. You know, I think that's really important. We have to give our bodies a chance to recharge and recuperate. And a lot of us are not giving ourselves the time that we need to heal at night. And it's a thing that I struggle with, especially because I deal with a lot of pain. So trying to get 8 good hours of sleep is very difficult, but it's an area that I've been really working on to try and improve for my own health and wellness. Eating clean organic foods is a staple. I have to do that. It's very difficult in this day and age to eat completely organic, but I do my best to eat, you know, organic fruits and vegetables. Most of my groceries that I buy are organic. Unfortunately, going to restaurants here and there, you can't always do that, but you just have to make the best choices that you can. Getting some form of physical activity every day, people don't get enough exercise and they don't get enough sleep, and they're constantly under a lot of stress just from their daily lives and the work schedules that they're under. And so we have to take care of the things that we can really control ourselves. And so sleep, nutrition, exercise, and managing my stress. And, you know, actually writing is cathartic for me. And so doing these articles and writing this stuff out there and putting it out for people and so that they can learn and grow from it is very cathartic. And that helps me to deal with my stress. And so those are like 4 really big fundamentals for me as far as keeping myself healthy. But another thing that I'm talking about, just finding time with my family, like doing stuff with my son, you know, having that connection, making sure that we spend the quality time together as a family, whether it's watching a movie or doing board games or anything that we can connect on that level. Because we had some hardships, in the year when my relative was really sick, that we just weren't together as much as a family. And so being able to bring us together and that to me is a huge part of keeping my own terrain healthy, is just the spiritual side, the connectedness, being able to keep my body clean through what I eat and drink. I only drink, purified water, reverse osmosis unit. We bought that just a few years ago, and that's been very helpful. So those are the type of things that I try to focus on for myself.
Sounds like an excellent foundation. Well, we've covered the websites where folks can find you, and we'll put the link in the show notes for everyone out there listening. The website is a treasure. Mike Stone, you are a treasure. We appreciate all the work that you're doing, and we really appreciate you coming on the show with us. So thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It was fun talking with both of you.
Mikey Mon, welcome to the after party in the Pioneer Room.
It's freaking freezing up here, Mr. Bigglesworth.
It's not actually freezing. I don't know where maybe it is where you are, but it's like raw. We got like rain. We had rain and sleet today, and it's that cold that seeps into your bones.
Yeah, it's that late winter New England murky gray, and then there's like this fear porn about chemical clouds coming over from Ohio just to top it all off. Yeah, I'm not going to give into that fear.
Yeah, that's some wild stuff. I mean, we got into the chemtrails and the pollution.
I was so happy to see that on his site. Like I said, I was just sitting over here, almost setting a new record for how late into a podcast Mike decides to chime in. But it's the website is so well organized, and like you said, it's not. I don't know. There's not like a lot of cheap shot memes or anything like that. It's very straight shooting.
Yeah,
and I appreciate that. I got sort of sucked in. And I was so pleased to see his bit on chemtrails. And what is it? Let's just call it what it is. We don't need to use fancy words like chemtrails. Air pollution.
Yeah.
Air pollution.
Yeah.
These are concepts I think normal people can understand. Yeah. It's talking to a guy like Mike Stone, who's just like so sort of humble and clear and smart. It's like, how is the world as messed up as it is with dudes like Mike Stone in it? Come on.
I keep coming back to this notion that there are actually more people who are rational out there than we think. And the reason we don't think there are is because what we consume for media all tells us just one side of the story. Yeah. And most of the media is just telling us one side and making us believe that there's a huge one side and there are masses of people who are all on that one side. And I just don't know that that's the case. So I don't trust when I hear messages like that. And I'm getting this sense that there are more folks out there who are open-minded and rational and critically thinking through some of what's happened the past few years and the decades prior.
I mean, from your mouth to God's ear. No, I don't think it's wishful thinking, although you have to put your like practical experience in line with it. But then also, like, you know, we're not only siloed in our media consumption, we're sort of siloed in the communities we've built over the last, you know, where we live. And, you know, I've spoken about like the music community, which is my community through and through, 20 years is by and large very much on board with the mainstream narrative about what does make you ill. So, you know, from my perspective, it's been few and far between finding like-minded people ever since since my red pill moment. You know,
maybe it comes back to that phrase, the silent majority, that there are folks who, even in your music community, folks who just went along with it, who didn't agree with it, but went along with it because everyone else did and they didn't want to rock the boat. We have this need. There's a human need to fit in, to not be cast out of the group.
Well, it's funny, even before COVID, this conversation came up, like, why aren't there more quote unquote protest singers? Like, why aren't there more people, you know, taking a stance and risking something? Well, it's very simple answer. There's the margins are so slim in this business already that to further alienate people, to be divisive, to risk having less butts in the seats, it just, whether you love Joe Strummer or not, it's like, it's real. Like the economics of the business are real. So our situation is unique, and it's, as the older I get, I realize it is a godsend that like we never got super big. We never got like Avett Brothers or Mumford and Sons big. And thank God for a whole bunch of different reasons, because it's allowed me, I think, to walk a more truthful path without fearing, you know, more of a fall from grace or retribution or backlash. You know, there's some backlash, but it's not, I don't think the stakes are as high when you're not as big of an act.
Or like the Boston's, which just brought down the band itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now we've been able to stay sort of nimble and pick our battles, but it's because we don't, it's like someone used that example, maybe it was Mike Donio, about like, you know, to turn a ship. It's like,
it takes a long time.
Whereas we can sort of pivot, you know, we use that word. We can actually pivot.
So not long after moving into this new house, as I think I've maybe mentioned this before on the podcast, I've mentioned it to other people, but met the neighbors up the road who run the little hobby farm, the 300-acre regenerative farm. Wonderful people. Not long after meeting them, these two dogs started showing up in the yard like every day, twice a day, three times a day. And they'd always come together. I suspect that they are owned by the folks up the hill on the farm. They're not approachable yet. They don't really know me, but they'll come up and they'll mark their territory, just yellow streaks and all the snow around the house. I've got their prints. Like, I'll wake up in the morning and there's like a whole new set of paw prints just all around the house. It looks like they're stalking me.
Yeah.
But one of the dogs looks exactly like the dog in Cujo.
Yeah.
And it's sort of older, so its eyes are reddish, like the whites of its eyes have turned reddish. And I can only think of Cujo when I see this dog. And it's the less friendly of the two. Like, when I come out of the house just to like, hey, what are you guys doing? It'll like bound off and then turn at me and stare angrily at me with its red eyes. And I'm like, you are one bat bite away from trapping me in my truck and breaking through the windshield. but no, it's not.
Predictive programming.
Yeah, predictive programming. Yeah. So we don't have to worry about rabies. I had a friend who this taller guy who was in the film and media industry and really a gentle giant of a person who I came to understand really loved nature. And he was driving home one night and he saw this baby raccoon on the side of the road that had been like abandoned by its mother. And he pulled over without even like thinking anything of it. He's like, I have to save this raccoon. So he like bundled it up in his jacket, brought it home, put it in a cardboard box, was like trying to feed it. And then the next day called, the animal folks. And they're like, well, now that you've handled it, like we have to put it down. We are he thought he was going to like find a home for it or maybe put it back into nature somehow, like give it to the pros. And they're like, well, no, we have to kill it. And now that you've handled it, like you should probably get your rabies shot. Just to be safe. And it occurs to me, Mike, that as we talk about root cause and our divorce from nature, that rabies is just one more way that we have been pushed away from nature and made to fear any animal, any wild animal that looks suspicious. And where I came from in Vermont, we had this thing, Front Porch Forum. So you would subscribe to Front Porch Forum and every town had its own. So when you subscribed, you had to pick your zip code. And it was basically just a listserv. So every day you'd get an email and your Front Porch Forum from your community would have like a list of posts from your neighbors. And it was all like neighborly stuff. I need help stacking wood or I found a lost glove on the trail. Is it anyone's? And so it was just a way to connect with your neighbor. And every week there was... saw a rat, you know, like a suspicious raccoon. I saw this animal, this fox that looked a little mangy and don't know if it has rabies. Mm-hmm. It's like everyone in the community, when they would see one of these animals that could carry rabies wander through their yard, it was like, it might have rabies. That was always a line in there. And to this day, I'm still subscribed. And there was just another sighting of a raccoon. I was like, it looked a little weird and jittery. And I think it might've been rabid. It's like, we're just going to go killing nature and we're going to avoid any contact with these animals because we think that we're going to get rabies and, you know, go crazy and die and foam at the mouth.
Just last night, we pulled up the driveway. It was after dark and, I've been catching raccoons to protect my chickens in my have a heart traps. And there was a big ass raccoon that just came like bounding around the corner of the chicken run. It wasn't in, didn't get in, didn't climb the fence. It was just on the outside. It's happy to see that my fence did something. Wasn't in a trap. I baited the traps, but as I was going out there to bait the traps, it's dark, fumbling with my stupid phone flashlight, trying to like, you know, put two pieces of pepperoni in the trap and like, as like in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, that was a big raccoon. And I guess in a Hollywood sense, it could come take a run at me. I know that's not going to happen, but I will say that I had dismissed the fear of any sort of like rabies idea. I thought no one wants to get bit by a fucking raccoon. Cause I've caught several of them now and they're quite big and they are like little bears. Like they growl at you and like, yeah. they do this like intimidating sniffing thing with their nose and like they've got tricks up their sleeve to intimidate and thumbs. But I was it did seem like some sort of evolution that I was able to sort of cross the rabies possibility off the list. But while we're speaking of animals,
I'm just going to interject, yeah, real quick. I think the sniffing is probably because it had never detected the odor coming off your poncho before. But that was a strange thing for. So I'm going to give that raccoon a pass on the sniffing.
You know, I wasn't going to mention this because it's sort of embarrassing, but I went and played hockey this morning. As Fridays, I go play hockey Friday mornings when I don't have a Thursday night skate, and I'm sort of wrecked for the rest of the day. It's like my full-on, full immersion cardio gym situation for the week. And I was making a rush and I was like, you know, arm in arm with this guy and sort of like fending him off with my weight and using my body to protect the puck. And the dude's like, dude, your equipment smells horrible. We got to find you a wife is what he said. I was like, oh my God. It's like hockey dudes and they're like a little banter on the ice making, sexist commentary and completely making me feel like pig pen. So I got home, I put all my equipment in the washing machine, or at least the stuff that wasn't like plastic. And that was sort of a wake up call. He's not wrong. Hockey equipment is vile. Absolutely vile. Yeah. I brought my skates to get repaired a couple weeks ago because the plastic part that holds the blade is called the Tuque, T-U-U-K. It cracked. And a local kid who works on skates said, I can fix that for you. And I spent an evening like thoroughly laundering my skates because like I cannot give these to another person. Like these are
embarrassing.
These are a biohazard. Like you say what you want.
I would say then if you sprinkle your hockey gear around the chicken coop.
Around the chickens. Yeah.
Those raccoons are never, they won't come within a mile.
I don't think so. It's funny. I was wearing my, because I just put it in the wash, my, you know, it's lights versus darks, right? Not laundry, but hockey.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my Make-A-Wish Foundation shirt is like still rocking from, I think I must've sent you a picture of it from what, like the 90s, you know, play like a Make-A-Wish Foundation benefit game. I think it was New Hampshire versus Vermont, actually. Yeah.
Your sweater.
Yeah.
Talking about your sweater, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I was going to talk about mice, because we brought this up with Mike Donio, and I just keep coming back to it. I feel like I'm turning into Tom Cowan. I like how, even at the Hoot, he had this really beautiful way of saying it. Like, I think my role in this space is to help people. And do you remember exactly how we finished that sentence?
Ask the foundational question.
Yeah, ask the foundational question. Yeah. And I've heard him talk about this in terms of like animal testing. It's like the foundational question is, why are we fucking with animals like this? And we were joking about it yesterday. I forget if it was in the after party or offline. You're like, where do you get tumor-filled mice? How about, where's the study that shows how to keep the most healthy family of mice? You know where that study is? It's in the fucking burrow, in the ground with their nuts and sunflower seeds and their little mice family, and not GMO food. And it's like, it becomes like very obvious how to have healthy mice. And then by contrast, all the hoops and gunk and toxic goo and petri dishes and radiation and to create sick mice that we then try to heal with chemicals, it's like we're mad scientists and it's happening right before our eyes, but we're just so used to it that we don't call bullshit.
I worked at the, in the psychology department for 2 summers at UNH. This is the summers in between college years, and second or third floor of the psychology department. They did studies. There's a lot of studies on the effects of like cocaine and different substances on the brain, and they used rats. So my job there was to usher the rats in and out of the testing cages, and then also handle like the new rats so that they could become used to humans and human handling, and then like clean out the rat mazes, and like logging and starting and stopping the experiment. So I was around that. I was in that environment. And it was really wild. And, you know, I think looking back, I would never take a job like that, but I did because it was a job. It was a good paying job. And was at the psychology department with some great people that interacted with my mom because she worked there.
Yeah.
But it was it was sort of horrifying because these rats would have their, you know, be injected with things like cocaine and then they'd monitor their reaction to that. And then they'd be sacrificed. They'd be killed. And then their brains would be examined to see the various physical changes that happened inside the brain. And that was my, you know, firsthand experience at the mad science, as you called it.
But normalizing. Do you think at some weird subconscious level, and this is maybe getting a little bit a bridge too far, but like that we are okay we're all aware that this happens. So we're like sort of complicit in a sense that because we are also lab rats in a greater civilizational system.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I felt when we came off that conversation with Mike Donio yesterday, and you and I were talking in the after party a little bit about that. I was like, well, that's what we are. Yeah. We are the lab rats. I mean, think about the injections that have happened in the last 2 years, and people have said, you guess what? You are the animal testing, because they, you know, essentially skipped the animal testing, right, and just rolled it right out into humans and rolled it right out into humans before the actual human trials were completed. So it was the whole hashtag
we are the control.
Yeah, we are the control, right? And congratulations, you are the test. Mm. You are the test subject. So that's not exaggeration, but you know, I don't like to alarm any of the listeners who may have consented to receiving it. But that, you know, it was interesting, Mike. I took a video today. I was taking a walk down the road to get my mail, and the town has been doing a lot of work on this road and the adjoining roads, some tree work to cut back trees and limbs from the power lines.
There's a lot of that. It just happened in my yard last week too. It must be
I took a video. I think I might share it to stories, but it basically goes like power lines, mm-hmm, and then this incredible stand of like pine trees just all the way back into the woods. And I look up and, well, I look down first, and right below is just limbs. Like they've just been by, but they haven't cleaned up yet. And it's just tree limbs, just heaps of tree limb. And I look up and the trees, all the limbs that were facing the power line is just gone. Like the trees all the way down the road are just limbless and on one side. And then they've got these limbs that are pointing, you know, off into the woods perfectly. And I'm like, man, if the role, like, just imagine the role being reversed, like your arms are in the way, your right arm, you row of humans, like your right arms are in the way, and we're just going to chop them off. And that's like what I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of like the tree hugging hippie right now, but I look at that and I'm like, that's just not good for the trees. And that is no way to treat a tree. That is no way to treat like our neighbor.
You're starting to sound like Derek Jensen. You know, yeah, it's like, well, yeah, we've got to have roads. Well, do you? You know, well, we have to have electricity. Do we?
I know.
Again, like foundational questions. And people say, oh, fucking Mike. Yeah, we need roads and electricity. Well, look at how we go about it. We just like cut right through ecosystems. And like you said, like I had a tree guy here, I guess last spring, who I love, Austin. He's a climber. I've probably spoken about him before. He's like a superhero. He's like a real life superhero.
Just the guy that has the don't worry, I hugged it first.
No, that's Tom. That's okay. My buddy Tom.
I like that you know your tree guys on like a first name basis.
Right, like know go your on farmer and know your tree guy. This is Austin. And Austin, he's like maybe our age, a little bit younger, but he has a lot of respect for the trees, right? Mm. Like as he was up, I was trying to clear a couple limbs to open up a little bit more sunlight for my garden. I don't want to take the whole big, beautiful oak tree down, but he was so cognizant and respectful about the shape of the tree and you know, trying to, you know, as first of all, he's like, I first called him. He's like, can you come do some tree work? And he doesn't call me back for a while. And then I mentioned like, you know, it's for my garden. And he was like there the next day. He's like, oh, you're trying to grow food. Like he's all about it. It's interesting. I like rose in his pecking order because it was, you know, it was food security based, which I thought was awesome. Clearly a like-minded bro. But the aesthetic of the tree was very important. He wasn't just going to cut half of it. He just wasn't going to cut limbs that opened up the most sunlight even. He wanted the tree to almost have like some dignity when he was done. He wanted it to still look beautiful and healthy. And that seems like that's working with nature, right? It's making it a little bit safer. It's opening up a little bit more sunlight, but it's respecting, again, like having respect and giving the tree dignity, that you're not just going to lop it. Like last week, they did the same tree. He also mentioned there is like a power line pole right behind the tree. And Austin is like, isn't it sort of great that tree hides that pole so you don't have to look at that pole? It is much closer than I realized. If the tree wasn't there, I'd be like, oh God, there's a huge power pole in my yard. Well, out of sight, not out of sight, out of mind, but like the tree is providing so much added value to my property because it's blocking some gross industry. And, right. But when the tree guys were here, they just, like you said, just a vertical line, and it doesn't look as nice as Austin left it.
Mm. Yeah. God. Well, you know what, Mike? On that note, I'm gonna wrap this after party. I'm gonna take another walk down there and just apologize to those trees.
Yeah, show them some love. I'm gonna bring back some dignity to their world.
Give them a little hug. Give them a little hug. Well, Mike Stone is a legend. Mike Miranda, you're also a legend. Folks out there listening, you're all legends.
Before you wrap, wrap.
Oh gosh, okay.
Ben Hardy, you are also a legend. I'm gonna pick up this thread. Folks, Ben was just the guest on a podcast. You did share it today on the Insta stories.
Yes.
Right? Courtney Turner, the Courtney Turner podcast. Courtney is spelled Courtnay, if I'm not mistaken.
Enay, yep. E-N-A-Y.
Okay, some extra letters in Courtney. But what a beautiful interview, Ben. I listened to it last night to hear you had expressed to me how you were like, prepping for the interview because you wanted to make sure you had your facts straight, like as a, you know, a voice for Terrain Theory. And, you know, we've interviewed so many people in the space, the Alex X and the Tom Cowans and the Andy Kaufmans and the Mike Stones and the Mike Donios. But just to, I have a very unique relationship to you and your journey, but to hear your story, I think is what is so moving about that interview. You know what? We can all look up the statistics and see the graphs. It's like, there's no shortage of that if that's what you're looking for, but it's the story. It's like coming from a heart-centered place of how you got to where you are. That's really what you focused on. And very gracious about, I liked how you said, if you're going on a hike with somebody who's falling behind, you're not going to say catch up or be sort of abrasive or not let them rest for a while. You're going to sort of hold people's hand and meet them where they are. And I think that's sort of the epitome of who you are. It's like you're so committed to reaching the most people that you realize the only way you're going to do it is with kindness and generosity. And that really came through in the interview. So for my money, you're at the top of the pack for advocates for this movement. And I think everyone should go check it out.
I appreciate that, Mike. I really do. I appreciate you listening and the feedback. I was nervous as all get out.
I know you were. But it was just like before the hoot, you were very nervous to moderate that panel. And I just want to keep reminding you that you are powerful. You're very smart and you are very good at what you do. Even though this is sort of a new space for us, you're very good at it.
Well, who does the affirmations at the end of the after party, Mike? Don't you be taking it. I appreciate it. Funny, funny story. You know this. She shared that the episode had gone live, and I looked in the description of the episode on Apple, and she had wrote Ben Hardy, founder of Terrain Theory, and I was like, oh no, that is not what I am. And I think I was pretty clear at the very top of that episode too, like, just so everyone knows, you know, this thing has been around forever and I'm just one person, like one spoke on the wheel. So I saw
Pastor versus Hardy.
Yeah, exactly. So I emailed her right away and I was like, thank you so much for putting this out there. And also, if you could, please tweet that to just say the Terrain Theory podcast, because I will take hell from the terrain folks and everyone else, rightfully so. I have founded nothing.
Good for you. Good on you for having that fine tooth comb.
Yeah. Anyway, so I appreciate
you're
that.
You're thorough in your general. I'm sure you were very nice when you approached her.
Yeah, I'm a good man and thorough. Well, thank you, Michael. And thank you folks out there for listening and tuning in. And remember, nothing you heard here should be taken as medical advice, as neither Mike nor I are medical experts. And remember that you are light, you are love, and you are your primary healthcare provider. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you on the next one.